all down a long gravel driveway. Details were hard to pick out as the daylight diminished, but it was clear that if someone had wanted to unload tranquilized tigers, he could have done it privately. A mailbox said Hall, with the house number under that, so he had the right place. When he'd seen as much as he could from the road, he drove out to the closest intersection of I-94 and parked off the road. Matson arrived 5 minutes later and pulled up behind him. "How does it look?" she asked, as they rendezvoused at Virgil's front bumper. "I could see at least two buildings from the road. We'll have to scout it before we go in. I'd suggest we park a couple hundred feet away from the driveway. Let me get a legal pad." He got a legal pad from his briefcase and a pencil and drew a quick schematic of the target address, showing what he'd been able to see of the house and the outbuilding, and shaded some areas that were heavily wooded. "The ditches are dry, so we'll be able to walk through them. If we come in from this side, we'll have to climb at least two fences, but from this point," he tapped his sketch, "we should be able to walk all the way around the place without anyone seeing us." "Any vehicles?" "Not that I could see," Virgil said. "After we scout it, one of us should run back to the trucks and use one to plug the driveway before we go in," Matson said. "If we're on foot and they make a break for it, they could be gone before we could get to our own vehicles." "Yes. You run. I've got these goddamn cowboy boots on and you've got sneakers, so you'll be quicker. Getting dark, we better move." Virgil led the way to the parking area he'd spotted while scouting. They got out, quietly as they could, and Matson whispered, "Virgil, get your gun." "Oh, yeah." He got his Glock out of the back, with the clip-on holster, and pressed his back against the truck door so it closed with a click instead of a slam. He led the way down the road toward the target address, and 50 feet short of the driveway, through the roadside ditch and over a fence, with a single barbed wire strand on top, and into the trees. Another fence, old, in poor condition, and barely visible, stopped them a few feet in, and they took a minute getting over it. Darkness was coming on fast now, but they had enough light to navigate. They moved slowly through the trees, stumbling over the occasional downed branch or hole in the ground, to where they could see the house and the building behind it. There were no open doors, nothing visible through the windows. "Driveway's the only way in or out," Matson said next to Virgil's ear. She slapped at her own face. They were in a swarm of mosquitoes. "Yeah." Virgil led the way around the open lot, staying back in the trees, both of them swatting at mosquitoes as they walked. When they'd gone all the way around, they'd learned nothing more, other than only a single light was shining in the house, and it was possible that nobody was inside. When they got out to the ditch at the other side of the house, Virgil whispered, "I'll go down to the driveway. You run to get your truck." "Car coming," she said, and pointed. The car had turned onto the road a half mile away and was coming toward them. They stepped back into the trees so they wouldn't be caught in the headlights. The car slowed, turned into the driveway. They could see it was a Toyota Corolla or something like that, and pulled all the way past the house. Somebody, they couldn't see who, got out of the car, and a moment later, a house door slammed. "Now there's somebody home, if there wasn't before," Virgil said quietly. "Probably a woman," Matson said. "Why?" "Because this far out, with a large lot and a barn or a tool shed, a guy would probably be driving a truck, not a small sedan," she said. Virgil said, "Huh, okay. That's not necessarily good. I was thinking it'd be a place where they could kill the tigers and cut them up, not somebody's home." "We'll see," Matson said. "I'll get the truck." She jogged off through the dark, and Virgil saw the lights go when she opened the truck door. At the same moment, another truck turned the corner, slowed as it passed Virgil's and Matson's vehicles, then came on, slowed again, turned down the driveway. Virgil heard the truck door slam and somebody go into the house. Matson followed a minute later, turned down the driveway, stopped her truck at the narrowest spot in the driveway, effectively blocking it. When she got out of the truck, Virgil asked, "What do you think?" "Well, you think the tiger thieves have murdered 3 people. We gotta be ready." "Let's knock," Virgil said. "Get your gun out. Keep it out of sight behind me. Don't shoot me in the back." They walked up to the door in that odd formation, Mattson behind him but very close, Virgil's Glock loose in its holster, his hand resting on the stock. Inconspicuously, he hoped. The interior door was open, and Virgil heard a woman call, "Tom, I think somebody's in the driveway." Virgil reached out and pushed the doorbell and heard the ding-dong inside. Mattson whispered, "You step 8 inches left, and I'll have a clear shot inside." A few seconds later, a man in a brown UPS uniform trotted down some interior steps and looked at them through the screen door. "Can I help you?" Virgil held up his BCA identification and said, "We're agents with the State Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. Are you Mr. Hall?" "Yes." He pushed open the screen door to come out, and Virgil and Mattson took a step backward, still locked in the too close formation to hide Mattson's weapon. "What can I do for you?" He was too... Virgil looked for the right word and came up with querulous. Hall was too questioning, too void of worry. Virgil half turned his head to Mattson and said, "I think we're okay." She said, "I do too." And Virgil felt her step back farther away. "What's going on?" Hall asked. Virgil gave him a brief explanation, and Hall's wife Alice came to the door carrying a towel and said, "The man was here? His telephone was here?" She was disbelieving. "That's what came up on the phone," Virgil said. "This specific address." "We're gone during the day," she said. "There hasn't been any sign of anybody around. We don't know anyone named Simonian." Virgil went to his phone, called up the BCA website, and showed the Halls the mugshots of Hamlet and Hank Simonian, and they both shook their heads. "I've never seen him," Tom Hall said. "We would have noticed strangers hanging around." Alice said, "Tom, take them out to the garage. Make them look in there so they know there's nothing out there." And to Virgil she said, "We wouldn't be skinning tigers in the house, would we?" Virgil had to smile. "Probably not. So go out and look in the garage." Virgil knew it was pointless, but he and Mattson went and looked and found a bunch of lawn equipment and a workshop. They thanked the Halls and left. "Wonder what happened?" Mattson asked at her truck. "Don't know, but I can't believe those guys knew anything," Virgil said. "I'll talk to Sandy, see what she has to say." Mattson left, headed for home and a nap. Virgil watched her taillights as they disappeared around the corner and scuffed down to his truck. He called Sandy, who said, "I can't believe the address could be that wrong. I'll look at the numbers again. Maybe I got something backward." She looked at the house numbers again, but they were correct. "I can't explain it," she said. "Maybe, I don't know. Maybe Hamlet was coming or going from somewhere else and he wouldn't turn his phone on until he got to that address. You know, like he didn't want to give away where he really was." "I haven't gotten the impression that Hamlet was a big thinker," Virgil said. "Then I guess I can't help," Sandy said. "Actually, I don't know exactly how the locator gizmo works. I'll try looking it up on the net and get back to you if I find anything." Virgil told her to hang on to Hamlet Simonian's cell phone and everything else. "When do you get back?" "Tomorrow night, if nothing else comes up." "Probably see you then," Virgil said. Virgil thought about driving around some more, but it was so dark that he wouldn't be able to see much at all. Discouraged, he headed out to I-94, saw a convenience store on the other side of the highway, and across from that, Red's County Bar and Grill. He pulled into the gas station and filled up, went inside to pay and to get some cheese crackers and a Diet Coke. Back in his truck, he opened the crackers and sat crunching on them, looking at the Red sign with its flashing neon red rooster. After a moment, he said, "Huh," and turned the truck that way. There were maybe 20 trucks and cars, mostly trucks, in the bar's parking lot. There were no other bars in the neighborhood, as far as Virgil knew. He clumped inside in his cowboy boots. Not much going on. A lot of people in booths, eating hamburgers and drinking beer. Two or three more on bar stools, and a couple of guys in the back shooting pool at a coin-op table. Nobody paid any attention to him, and he walked over to the bar, and the bartender put a napkin in front of him and asked, "What can I get you?" "Is the manager around?" The bartender was a square, white-haired man with a tightly cut beard and rimless glasses sitting on a round nose. He might have been Santa Claus, except for the boxing scars under his eyes. "We don't rightly have a manager," he said. "What we have is an owner. Who's me?" Virgil pulled out his ID and explained his problem and how the bartender/owner might help him. "If you don't mind?"
"Well, it's weird, but I guess I don't mind," the bartender said. "Give us something to talk about when you're gone."
"Thanks," Virgil said. He stepped to the middle of the bar and called out, loud enough to break through the chatter.
"Hey, everybody. I'm a cop. I need your attention for a minute."
The chatter stopped, and the pool players backed away from the table, and everybody looked at him. And Virgil said,
"I'm with the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, and I'm looking for the stolen tigers. We think they might be in this neighborhood. Well, on the other side of the highway, anyway. Someplace south of here. What I want to know is, have any of you seen anything even a little unusual in the area?"
He described the Hall's place as the most likely general location and waited. There was a buzz, but people were shaking their heads. Then a woman said,
"I don't know, but I know who would."
"Who's that?"
"Buddy Gates."
Somebody said, "Oh, hell yes."
"Who's that?"
Virgil asked.
The woman said, "The rural route carrier out here. He knows every single house."
"Of course," Virgil said. Nobody knew how to get in touch with Buddy Gates, but somebody knew he worked out of the post office in Lakeland, which of course was closed. There was a general head-scratching until somebody said,
"I think he does live in Lakeland. You could ask down there."
Somebody else said,
"Buddy does drink a little. You could ask down at York's."
York's, it turned out, was the only bar in Lakeland. Virgil drove down to Lakeland, parked at the bar, went inside, and asked the bartender about Gates. The bartender introduced him to a woman named Judy, who told him that Gates lived in kind of a hard place to identify, but she'd be glad to show him the way. Virgil followed her down the highway a few hundred yards, then back into a neighborhood of 1960s ranch houses, and pointed out her window at a house with lots of lights in the windows. Virgil waved at her, and she headed back to York's. Gates was home, smelling strongly of marijuana, and when Virgil told him what he wanted, he said,
"I wonder what those dudes were up to."
Gates led the way to the back of his house, where a woman with glossy blonde hair was sitting in a Lazy Boy with her feet up, watching The Vampire Diaries. Gates said,
"Gotta help a cop find the tigers."
And she said, "Shh." Gates turned on his computer, brought up a Google map, switched to a satellite view, found the spot.
"Here's where you was," he said.
He touched the screen with a pencil.
"That's the Hall's house right there. And here's where these guys was."
He touched the screen again, where Virgil could see the roofs of a house and barn. The structures were on the other side of the Hall's backwoods, probably no more than 150 yards away.
"The reason the Halls didn't know about them was they're on a completely different road, and the two roads don't hook up with a crossroad for almost a half mile either way," Gates said. "No reason for anybody on either road to go onto the other one. The reason it didn't come up on the telephone was it's not an official address anymore. This guy from out of state bought about 5 places over there as investments and merged them into one new subdivision. The closest official address is the Halls."
Virgil showed him the pictures of Hamlet and Hicksimonian, and Gates said,
"I'm not completely sure, but this one,"
he touched the Hake photo,
"I think I talked to him just a day or two ago."
The woman in the chair said, "Would you guys shut up?" Virgil went back to the front door, where Gates filled him in on the countryside around the house and barn where he'd seen Hake. Virgil thanked him, and as he was leaving said, I wouldn't necessarily recommend you invite a cop inside when you've been smoking dope.
It's medicinal, Kate said. Besides, does anybody really care anymore?
Virgil thanked him again, went out to his truck, and called Mattson. The phone rang, but she didn't answer. He left a message on her voicemail and tried Jenkins. Jenkins answered, but he and Shrake were in St. Cloud, which had to be the best part of 100 miles away. Virgil decided to wait for Mattson, but until she called, he'd go scout the house that Gates had identified. He drove back through the rat's nest of roads to the Hall's house, then past it, a half mile down, over another quarter of a mile, then back toward the target address. He found the driveway and eased on past, but could see nothing down the driveway except one dim light in the house. He couldn't see the barn at all, which Gates had described as dirt-colored. Virgil left his car 100 yards down the road, on the side away from I-94. If Peck was in the house and decided to drive out, he'd probably be going out toward the interstate. On foot now, Virgil snuck back to the driveway, crouched at the entrance, listening, then walked down toward the house, staying as much as he could in the brush along the side of the drive. Took his time, no rush now. As he got closer, he could see the thinnest rime of light in a rectangular shape out past the house. A door, he thought. He kept moving, slowly, slowly, listening all the time, his pistol in his hand now. Went past the house, stepped on something, dropped his hand to it, an electric cord snaking off toward the barn. Another few steps, something else, a hose. Took his time, listening. No sound at all from the house, no sign of a vehicle. He thought about that, wondered if Peck had gone somewhere else. The light in the house was nothing you'd read by. Another minute, and he was next to the barn door. The door opened inward. He thought about it for a moment, listened some more, then pushed on it. The light inside was bright and cut a pencil-thin shaft across his jeans. He pushed a bit more, and now could see inside. And he could smell what was in there. And it was awful. A combination of spoiled meat and rotten blood, and maybe tiger shit, he thought. Nobody there. Then something moved at the back, and two lamp-like eyes turned toward him from behind a chain-link fence. A goddamn tiger, he thought. He'd found them. Or one of them. He caught the door with his fingernails, pulled it closed again, and turned to the house. As he did it, the phone in his pocket began to vibrate. He didn't answer, but slipped around the corner of the barn and walked down the side of it until he was nearly to the back. Shielding the phone screen from the house, he looked at it. Mattson. Called her back, and she picked up on the first ring. I was in the shower, missed your call. I found them, Virgil said. They're in a barn at a house right behind the Halls, but on a different road, a road that's parallel to the one the Halls are on. You can see them both on the Google satellite. One tiger's alive. There's nobody in the barn except the tiger, but maybe somebody in the house. You got your gun with you? Yes. I'm on the way, Mattson said. 34. Peck had been asleep in the farmhouse. There was no furniture in the place, but Hake Simonian had brought in a foam pad, and Peck passed out on it, partly from exhaustion and partly from the drugs. He awoke in the dark and was disoriented. The first thing he recognized was the smell of the place, mostly dry rot, rodent shit, and dust, with a lingering stink from the tiny bathroom. None of the plumbing worked, but Simonian had used the toilet anyway. He'd later tried to flush it with a bucket of water, but the pipes were screwed up, and he was only partially successful. The electricity still worked, but since they didn't use the house for much, Hamlet Simonian had installed only one light bulb in the kitchen, leaving his fingerprints all over it, Peck assumed. Peck had dragged the foam pad into the mudroom, which still had functioning screens. because the house was too hot and the cross ventilation from the open windows kept the Hicksonian stink at bay. In the dim light of the 60-watt bulb, he pushed himself up, popped a Xanax, opened the door, took a step down, unzipped, and peed off the side of the back stoop. As he was doing that, he saw a crack of light to his left at the barn, and a figure in the light. That fucking Flowers. No question about it. Caught in midstream, he tried to get back inside the house without peeing on himself, and succeeded, mostly, except for one hand, but did pee all over the foam pad and in the doorway to the main part of the house. At that point, figuring he was near the end anyway, he finished peeing on the kitchen floor, wiped his hands on his pants, and got the rifle. Getting as close to the kitchen light bulb as he could, without throwing shadows that might give him away, he carefully extracted the magazine from the bottom of the rifle, cursing himself for not loading it earlier, and began to fumble cartridges into the magazine. He didn't know exactly how many rounds the magazine would hold, but he managed to press in 8 or 9 before he knocked the cartridge box off the kitchen counter, and the metallic cartridges hit the floor like a rain of steel bolts. That panicked him. He tried to shove the magazine into the rifle, but got it backward. Couldn't make it fit. Realized what he was doing when he saw the pointed end of the top bullet aimed at his eye. He turned the magazine around and managed to seat it, and he worked the bolt to chamber around. 2 Xanax-calmed thoughts about Flowers. He had to go because he stood between Peck and his truck. He had to go because the barn was full of live tiger and dead tiger parts, and more troubling, fingerprints left by Winston Peck. The whole $250,000 dream was going down, but if he could kill Flowers, he could dump the gas cans in the barn and the house and burn them to the ground. That would take care of the prints and any DNA that might be around, as well as the man who had somehow tracked him here. If he could kill Flowers, he had a chance. Virgil snuck back to the front of the barn to peek at the house, and when he did it, he saw a flicker in the light from the kitchen, and seconds later, the sound of metallic cartridges falling on the floor. He knew the sound because he and his hunting buddy Johnson Johnson had dropped any number of metallic cartridges on the floor of any number of hunting cabins. That sound meant that somebody, probably Peck, was loading a gun, which meant that the gun wasn't quite loaded. Virgil ran as softly as he could to the front of the house, because the kitchen, where the light was in the back. He took his gun out and climbed the sagging front porch steps. At the top, he tried to see through the glass rectangle in the front door, but it was dark inside, and he could see nothing. The porch boards creaked underfoot as he moved to the door, and Virgil hesitated, listened, then took another step forward. When he put his foot down, the porch board collapsed with a noisy clatter, and Virgil went through up to his right thigh. As he struggled to get out of the hole, the boards under his other foot began to crack, and he could go neither up nor down easily. He set his gun aside and tried to pull himself out of the hole with his hands, as if he'd fallen through lake ice. Peck had stepped out on the urine-soaked back stoop thinking that he might see Flowers either coming or going from the barn. He wasn't confident of his combat skills, but he had little choice. Flowers had to go, and the range would be short. He put the rifle up to his shoulder, as he'd seen soldiers do on news broadcasts, wrapped his finger around the trigger, and waited, and heard Virgil fall through the porch floor. He knew exactly what had happened, because he'd almost gone through himself. If Flowers had fallen through, he'd be at least temporarily discombobulated, and Peck might shoot him from the range of 6 feet. He turned and ran down the side of the house, looked under the porch railing, saw Virgil on his hands and knees. Virgil saw him at exactly the same moment, and Peck pushed the gun through the railing directly at Virgil's chest and pulled the trigger. The trigger didn't move, and Peck's brain froze. Virgil saw that, knew what had happened. Peck's gun's safety was on, but it could be off again in a quarter second, and launched himself at the front door, smashed it open, and rolled inside. Straight ahead was a stairway leading to a second floor and a hallway that led to the kitchen. If he took the hallway, he'd be silhouetted in the thin kitchen light. He took the stairs. Peck wasn't as quick on the uptake as Flowers, but realized in the next second that the gun's safety was on. He thumbed it off and ran around to the porch stairs in time to see Flowers topping the stairs inside, and fired a single shot, wildly off target. A plume of plaster dust exploded from the ceiling of the second floor landing, 2 feet above and 3 feet to the right of Flowers' head. He saw Flowers launch himself into a bedroom. That bedroom was a dead end. He worked the bolt on the rifle, chambering another round, climbed the porch steps, careful now, and kicked Flowers' pistol. He had an idea of what it was, because Flowers had been clambering out of the hole in the porch with both hands open and hadn't had time to scoop it up before crashing through the door. Peck picked up the pistol, thinking it would be handier in an up-close fight, though he knew almost nothing about handguns. He tried to find a safety, failed, and pulled the trigger instead. He'd been holding the gun nearly upright when he did that, not expecting it to go off. And when it did, the recoil not only wrenched his hand backward, but he nearly shot himself in the nose. Additionally, something hit his left eye, like a piece of sand, but a hot, burning piece of sand, and his eye shut of its own accord. When he tried to open it, it flooded with tears. Worse, when the pistol went off, he'd been so startled he'd dropped it, and it had fallen through the hole in the deck of the porch. He was back to the rifle, and half-blinded. He shouted up the stairs. "Hey, Flowers, lose your gun?" Flowers yelled back. "Can't talk now. I'm on my cell phone telling my partner exactly where you're at and everything that's happened tonight. You fucking toast, asshole. Better give it up or you're gonna die here." Peck pointed the gun at the bedroom door. He could see only an edge of it from the bottom of the stairs, and pulled the trigger. Worked the bolt, pointed it again, and pulled the trigger again. His eye hurt like hell, but when he wiped it with his shirt sleeve, the tearing seemed to have stopped, and he got some vision back in that eye. He worked the bolt again, climbed halfway up the stairs, and fired another shot through the wall of the bedroom. Virgil was lying on the floor under the bedroom window. As long as Peck stayed down the stairs, it'd be hard to get a slug to him. If he came up the stairs, Virgil had a major problem. The bedroom wasn't much bigger than a modern closet, and Peck could stand back and blow holes in it all night long, depending on how much ammo he had. Sooner or later, Virgil would get hit. And the third shot, because of its angle through the wall, seemed to Virgil to come from the stairway, not from the bottom floor. He had to move. He waited, and Peck shouted, "Gotcha, Flowers!" And Virgil yelled back, "I don't believe you do." And when the fourth shot came through the wall, knowing that Peck would have to work the bolt, he stood up and kicked the rotten double-hung window right out of its frame. He struggled through the window, exposed now, afraid Peck would run down the stairs and catch him. But another shot came through the wall, missing him by 3 feet. Virgil hung for a moment from the window ledge, looking down in the dark. Couldn't see anything at the bottom, but figured his feet were no more than 6 or 7 feet off the ground. He let go, hit the stone edging of an ancient flower bed with both feet, the pain lancing through both ankles and up past his knees as he fell down. He'd sprained both ankles, he thought. Goddamn cowboy boots. He got to his feet and tried to run away, but he heard the bedroom door smash open. Peck must have heard him kicking the window out, and he started juking back and forth as he ran toward the nearest cover, which was the barn. He was 10 feet away, waiting for the impact of the bullet tearing through his back, when Peck fired, and the bullet missed. But it was close enough to hear it go by, an actual zing sound that was unmistakable if you'd heard it before. Virgil hit the barn door like a linebacker and sprawled inside, in the bright light, rolled out of the line of fire as another bullet smashed through the rebounding door. Virgil rolled over next to it and kicked it shut. And here he was. No gun, his ankle screaming at him. Beside a door that was as good as a target, in the basement of a building with no other door and no windows. One good thing, the walls were made of stone, so Peck wouldn't be knocking holes in it. He looked for something he could use to block the door, which opened inward, but nothing seemed likely to be heavy enough. There was a table, but it was made from a sheet of 4x8 plywood laid over sawhorses. He limped over to one of the dryers, but it probably didn't weigh more than 20 pounds. And he had no time. Peck was coming. His best chance, he decided, would be to try to take the guy in the dark. There were three bright lights overhead, and Virgil grabbed a knife off the plywood table and stabbed the first bulb, smashing it. Smashed the second one, and as he was about to smash the third one, noticed an unremarked-upon feature of the whole tiger-cleaning lash-up. "There," he said to himself, "is an interesting possibility." He smashed the third light, and in the sudden, impenetrable darkness, fished his cell phone out of his pocket, punched the recall button for Mattson, and clutching the knife in one hand, crawled into the vacant tiger cage left behind when the Simonians dragged out the dead Artur. Mattson answered the phone and said, "I'm on the way." "Listen," Virgil said, "I'm in deep trouble. I'm trapped in the barn in back, and Peck is coming for me with a rifle. I lost my gun." Peck was crossing the barnyard with his best airborne ranger combat killer simulation, his rifle at his shoulder, one round visually confirmed in the chamber, the safety off, ready to go. As he got closer, he could hear somebody talking inside the barn, and not, he thought, from right behind the door. Sounded farther away than that. He tiptoed up to the barn door and listened. Flowers was saying, "Don't let him quit. If he gets me, kill him. He's got that rifle. You'll have every chance in the world, and nobody will question it. Kill the motherfucker." Peck was quite calm about it, hearing his own death sentence. It was apparent that Flowers had given up on some level, but on another level was making sure that Peck would pay. Peck started to tear up again. That wasn't fair. He'd won. He'd beaten Flowers fair and square, and now Flowers was ratting him out to the world? He didn't burst into the barn to stop it, though. Instead, he pushed the door open a quarter inch and put his good right eye to it. Everything inside was dark, except the cell phone, and as he watched, he could see the reflection off Flowers' face. There was no kind of tricky thing going on, like with the cell phone being in the back of the barn while Flowers hid behind the door. He kept his eye to the door, fished out his own cell phone, brought it up, and turned on the flashlight app. He pushed the door open with his foot, aimed the rifle at Flowers, and stepped inside in the dark. He said, in his best airborne ranger combat killer voice, "You're all done." Flowers' cell phone light went out as Flowers apparently dropped it face down in the dirt. That didn't help him, though, as Peck aimed his own cell phone light at the back of the barn and stepped out across the barn floor. Flowers, he realized, had hidden himself in Artur's cage. Flowers said from across the barn floor, "I still don't think so." "Know what I'm gonna do?" Peck asked. "I'm gonna dump 20 gallons of gasoline on—" Flowers interrupted. "You know what I already did?" Peck couldn't help himself. "What?" "I let the other tiger out." Peck momentarily froze, or most of him did. His hair didn't. It stood up all over his body. Mouth open, Xanax totally failing, Peck turned the cell phone light to his right and saw two amber coals glowing in the dark. Close. Getting closer. What Virgil had seen before he smashed out the last light was the two simple snap shackles that locked the chain-link farm gates of the tiger cages. They were secure enough, a tiger wasn't going to figure them out, but they were also easy enough to undo. If he knelt inside of the empty cage, he could reach over the half-closed door of that cage and unshackle Koch's door. He did that, in the light of his cell phone, and pulled his own door shut and shackled it just to be sure the cat couldn't somehow get in. Koch didn't move right away, but when she did, it was all at once. The big golden orange and black cat rolling to her feet, nosing out through the open door. The barn door opened inward, so Virgil thought the cat probably couldn't get out of the barn on her own, but if he could get Peck inside without getting shot himself. Peck did like to talk, would probably want to claim victory. Now Peck's cell phone flipped up in the air as he tried to bring his rifle around, but he was way, way too late. Katya hit him like a furry cannonball, and Virgil put his hands to his ears and closed his eyes, not willing to witness the rest of it, even in the dim light of a cell phone. Thankfully, the screaming ended with a loud crunching of skull bones. Then Katya roared, a full-bore, full-throated Siberian forest after-the-kill roar, and some atavistic gene in Virgil's personal gene pool sat up and screamed, "Run, dummy!" He couldn't. He sat and listened to Katya make a dug, dug, dug sound. A moment later, she started dragging Peck's body back to her lair. She had trouble getting the body across the gate stop bar on the floor, but managed, after tossing her head for a moment or two, settled in the far corner, and after giving Virgil an appraising look, went back to work on Peck. Virgil eased his cage door open 1 inch, 2 inches, ready to slam it back in place. At 6 inches, he reached one arm out and managed to hook Katya's cage door and pull it shut. Katya stopped chewing, gave him another look, and went back to Peck. Still kneeling behind his own door, Virgil got a snap shackle back in place on Katya's cage, then pushed his own cage door farther open and got the second shackle on. He turned back into his cage and picked up the phone. Matson was shouting at him. "I'm okay," he said. "Where's Peck?" "He's, Peck's at dinner." 35. When Matson turned her truck into the barnyard, her headlights played across Virgil, who was sitting in the barnyard in the dirt, his legs out in front of him, talking on his cell phone to John Duncan. She hopped out of her truck and heard him say, "We need everybody out here, crime scene, medical examiner, the zoo people, and tell the zoo people to bring a tranquilizer gun. We've got to get that tiger out of its cage before she eats the rest of Peck." Virgil clicked off the phone as she trotted over to him and asked, "What happened?" "That's a little hard to explain," Virgil said. "It got really complicated." "Why are you sitting in the dirt like that?" she asked. "I sprained both my ankles when I jumped out of a second-story window." "What?" She turned to look at the farmhouse, where, in the reflected headlights of her truck, she could see a window frame dangling from a few nails on the second floor. "I told you it was confusing," Virgil said. "Help me up. I need to find my gun." "What happened to your gun?" "Well, see, I fell through the floor of the front porch." Matson supported him with an arm around his waist, and he put one of his arms around her shoulders as they limped over to the front porch. On the way, he gave her the whole sequence from the time he arrived at the farm until he managed to lock Katya back in her cage with Peck's body. "If it was anyone else, I wouldn't believe it. With you, I think, yeah, probably," she said. At the porch, they didn't see a gun, and Virgil said, "Peck must have picked it up. He never fired it, though." They worked carefully around the hole in the porch deck and stepped inside the house. There was no pistol in the entry, and Matson climbed the stairs to the second floor and returned empty-handed. "There's some 308 brass on the bedroom floor up there, so I was in the right room, but I didn't see any 9mm, she said. "I'll get a flashlight." She got a mag light from her truck and left Virgil sitting on a porch step, contemplating the quiet of the night as she traced Peck's route from the bedroom down to the barn. She came back and said, "Nothing in the barn. The tiger is sitting there staring at Peck. What's left of him, anyway. I don't see a gun on his body. Really stinks in there." Virgil thought for a moment, then said, "Look down the hole in the porch." She did, shining the flashlight down it, and a second later said, "I see it. Can't reach it, though." "Embarrassing as hell," Virgil said. "But if you'd been here..." Matson said, "Yeah." And, "Just a minute." The porch had a skirt of weather-worn wooden slats in no better condition than the rest of the porch. She kicked out a half-dozen slats, then crawled under the porch, got his gun, backed out, and handed it to him. She said, "Maybe we won't have to mention the whole gun thing." "Yeah, we will," because if we don't, the whole rest of it doesn't make any sense. There was some tall, uncut grass growing up next to the porch steps, and Virgil pulled out a blade and chewed on the stem, savoring the sweetness of it, and tried to forget the pain in his ankles. "You got a tiger back," Matson said. "That's a wonderful thing, Virgil." "I suppose," Virgil said, "but basically it was just more crazy shit." Matson cocked her head and asked, "Hear that?" Sirens, several of them, still a long way out. "About time," Virgil said. Matson sat on the porch next to him, looked out at the road. A greenish-yellow light blinked in the weeds out along the road, and she said, "Last firefly of the year." Fireflies weren't supposed to last this deep into the summer, Virgil knew. Maybe he was getting a signal from God, from one of God's bugs. But what would a yellow light mean? Caution? A little late, huh? Virgil's ankles were on fire, but he couldn't leave the scene until all the relevant crime scene processing was underway. Matson met the first responders, a couple of Washington County Sheriff's deputies, and asked them to park in the road because most of the barnyard was a crime scene. Two BCA agents were next, and they began taping off the scene. An ME's investigator arrived, followed by the BCA crime scene crew, followed by John Duncan. "The zoo people are getting their stuff together. They'll be here in a half hour or so. I talked to the TV stations. They all got something on the end of their newscasts. They'll be sending out some trucks to get video for tomorrow." "I'm kind of hurting here," Virgil said. "Could you and Katrin talk to them?" Duncan and Matson could. The TV trucks got there before the zoo people. Virgil was making a recorded video statement on the porch of the farmhouse when the zoo people arrived with a truck and a man with a tranquilizer gun. There was some back and forth between the zookeepers and the crime scene crew, but eventually one zoo guy was allowed inside the barn. He shot Katya, and he and two crime scene crew members lifted the unconscious cat onto one of Peck's dollies, and they rolled her out to a truck. The TV crews were allowed to stand on the shoulder of the road and film the transfer of the tiger to the zoo truck. A minute later, the hatch was closed, and the sleeping Katya was on her way back to the zoo. "Hope she makes it," Matson said, looking after the truck. "The zoo guy told me that tranquilizing them can be dangerous." The ME's investigator and the crime scene people began consulting about the removal of Peck's body. The investigator told Virgil, "She didn't eat him much, but she did crush his head like an English walnut." Jenkins and Shrake arrived, way too late to do anything. In fact, they weren't even supposed to be at the farm, but when they heard what happened, they'd driven out, hoping to get in on the action. Instead, Duncan asked for a volunteer to drive Virgil first to a hospital for x-rays and then home. Jenkins volunteered to drive him, and Shrake would follow with Virgil's truck. Jenkins and Shrake helped Virgil out to Jenkins's Crown Vic. The process was filmed by the TV crews, and Jenkins said, "We're all gonna be famous." "For tomorrow," Virgil said. "The day after, not so much." At Regent's Hospital, the ER was enjoying a low-key night, and Virgil got the x-rays done and examined in an hour. Getting his cowboy boots pulled off hurt almost as much as the original fall. The doc said, "Nothing broken. You need some rice." Rest, ice, compression, and elevation. Virgil had been there before. The doc wrapped his ankles and gave him a supply of cold packs. Then Virgil was driven home by Jenkins, with his tightly wrapped, freezing feet up on the Crown Vic's dashboard. Virgil talked to Frankie as he and Jenkins drove south through the cities, and she met them on Virgil's porch. She'd already asked him how bad the ankles were, and now she asked, after kissing him, "You can't walk?" "I can, but it hurts," Virgil told her. He was carrying his cowboy boots. "He's being a sissy," Jenkins said. "I've been hurt a lot worse than this and still played basketball." "Bullshit, Jenkins," Frankie said. "I've seen you stung by a wasp and you cried like a baby. Anyway, get him inside. I won't be able to help much." Shrake arrived, and they all got Virgil on the living room couch with his feet up on a couple of cushions and put the used cold packs in the freezer. Jenkins and Shrake left to go back to the cities, and Frankie, who was a bit of a cop groupie, settled into a chair opposite him and said, "I've heard enough about your ankles. What I want to hear is, what happened when you figured out where he was? I want it minute by minute, with all the blood and spattered out brains and stuff." He told her, minute by minute. She flinched when he told her about being shot at in the upstairs bedroom, but was nothing but delighted when he told her about the walnut crunch sound of the tiger crushing Peck's head. "Deserved every bit of it," she said. "Go, gotcha." If anything, Virgil's ankles hurt worse in the morning, a shooting pain when he moved that told him to stay off his feet. At 10 o'clock, he got a call from B. Sawyer, head of the crime scene crew. "Can you talk?" "Yeah, it's my ankles that hurt, not my tongue," Virgil said. "Okay, anyway, we found Peck's cell phone on the barn floor. And guess what? It was another one of those fingerprint password things. The tiger hadn't eaten his fingers, and we still had the body. So we opened it up and changed the settings to eliminate the password." "Yeah, yeah, and what?" "Roger went through his photos to see if he'd documented all of this, and he found the most amazing documentary film. It shows a younger Asian man strangling an older Asian man in the front seat of Peck's truck."
"Oh, man," Virgil said. "You gotta call Hauser at Minneapolis Homicide."
"It's done," she said. "That Zhang guy was leaving for the airport when they snagged him."
"B, thank you.
One more thing," she said.
"Yeah?"
"That firebomb that was thrown through the window of your neighbor's house? We're thinking it came from Peck's barn. A ball jar was used to hold the gasoline in the firebomb, and the basement in the farmhouse is full of old ball jars. There's a piece missing from an apron in the barn, and it looks like the same fabric used on the bomb."
"Oh, boy. I'm gonna have to do some patching up with the neighbors."
He watched the noon news, and Shrake had been right. They were heroes, for the moment. There was some question about whether Katya would have to be put down, since she'd killed a human being. On the other hand, John Duncan, did he have a tear in his eye? Told the story of Virgil using the tiger to defend himself against a mass murderer, so there was a solid argument that the killing had been justified. As they'd sat waiting on the farmhouse porch for everybody to arrive, Mattson told Virgil that Blankenship had bailed out of the Blue Earth County Jail. "Freddie has already made a deal with the county attorney. He's given them a statement saying that Blankenship was the person who did the beating in both assaults. They've already gotten a gum scrub from Blankenship for the DNA match, so that should nail it down. He's going to jail, or maybe even prison. But he probably won't get as much time as you want."
"Can't know that yet," Virgil said. "Frankie's friends with every judge in Blue Earth and Nicollet counties, so..."
That all became relevant as Virgil sat on the couch at home that afternoon, with his feet up in the air. Frankie was at her salvage shop at the farm. Sparkle called in a panic. "That Blankenship guy who beat up Frankie and Ramona? Me and Bill were out on the road getting mail, and he cruised us. I'm almost sure it was him. It was a red Ford truck, and I got the license number. He was looking at us."
"Oh, man.
All right, let's get the sheriff on it," Virgil said. "If the tag number checks out, he can have somebody go over and talk to him, warn him off.
Virgil, the guy's not only mean, he's insane."
"I'll talk to the sheriff now."
That evening, every news channel that Virgil saw reported that the population of Minnesota was in an uproar about the possibility that Katya might be put down. The possibility was evaporating. By the second day, after a continuous regime of rest, ice, compression, and elevation, and a couple of long chats about life with Father Bill, Virgil started moving around the house with the help of crutches that Frankie got from a drugstore. He was alone in the house, headed back to the couch, when an RV pulled up to the curb. Virgil said to himself,
"The fucking Simonians. Exactly what I needed."
Sure enough, six of them got out and seemed to arrange themselves by age and size. Levon led the way up Virgil's porch and pushed the doorbell. Virgil pulled the door open and said, "You might as well come in. I can't move around so well." The Simonians followed him into the living room.
The youngest one asked,
"You need anything? Painkillers? A little weed? Some liquor? Anything to make it easier?"
"I'm fine," Virgil said. "What's up with you guys?"
Levon said, "We will go back to Glendale, thank the good Lord, as soon as we wind up our business here, the arrangements for Hake and Hamlet."
"I'm sorry they were killed," Virgil said. "We think Peck might have murdered another man as well, but there's no body. And Peck, of course, can't tell us one way or the other where he might be."
Levon said, "We see this on the television news. We have also researched this Virgil Flowers on the internet because we have a large Simonian problem."
"Virgil, which would be?"
"This man Peck murders two of our Simonians. We wanted to deal with this ourselves, but that did not happen. Then we find out that our friend Virgil Flowers feeds Peck to a tiger, and this is better than anything we could think of.
I didn't exactly feed him, but anyway, I don't see a Simonian problem here," Levon said.
"We have a large debt to you. Our Simonian honor requires that the debt be paid, so we come here and ask, what does Virgil Flowers want?"
"A little peace and quiet, that's about all," Virgil said.
Levon pulled on his chin, glanced out to the street as if checking for cops, and said, "I tell you, Virgil, coming from L.A., you have here more peace and quiet than I could stand."
"Yeah, okay," Virgil said. "But guys, what happened was my job. I got paid for it. You don't owe me anything."
"This is where you are wrong," Levon said, and the other five Simonians all nodded. "Anyway, we tell you, we will pay this debt. We will be here, the medical examiner says, for another week, maybe 10 days. But since the murderer is dead and there will be no trial, they will not have to hold the bodies of our Simonians longer than that. We will find a way to pay."
Virgil said, "You don't owe me. Get that through your heads. Anything you give me, I'd have to turn into the state. I can't take any kind of payment outside my job. That would be considered a bribe."
Levon nodded and said, "Stupid law. We will go around it."
They all filed out, each of them giving Virgil a slap on the back or an elbow nudge, and when the RV pulled away from the curb, Virgil collapsed on the couch, grateful for the thickness of his peace and quiet. The sheriff talked to Blankenship and told Virgil,
"He denied being out there, but he was lying. I told him that if he messed with Ms. Nobles or her sister, or you, or anybody else, or even looked at any of you, I'll jerk his bail so fast his head'll be spinning for a week."
Matson came down to give a statement in the Blankenship case and stopped at Frankie's farm on the way back home. They all had a nice chat, and Virgil again didn't know whether to hug her or shake hands when she left, as she stepped away and said, "See you around." When she was gone, Sam, the youngest, said, "That chick is really hot." They all looked at him, but he didn't back off.
"When you're right, you're right."
On the third day, Maxine Knowles was charged with another count of attempted murder for her assault on Toby Strait, and her bail was pulled on the first count. A newspaper story said that the trial on the first count was scheduled to start in a month and a half. That was actually at the bottom of the news story. At the top was a long feature about a rich animal lover named Crudson from Minnetonka who had donated $250,000 to Knowles's animal refuge and its elderly caretakers. Virgil would never suggest that news people were cynical, but the story concluded with, "Questioned by a reporter, Crudson agreed that the contribution made to Knowles's charitable organization would be fully tax-deductible." That same day, John Duncan called and said that since Virgil had a job-related injury, he wouldn't be required to qualify with his pistol until the following year.
"We thought that would be best for everybody," Duncan said.
By the eighth day after Peck's death, Virgil was walking without crutches, though his ankle still hurt and felt wobbly. A doc told him that without the rice, it might have taken him a month or more before he could jog. He thought Virgil might start jogging in another week. Virgil, he said, probably had a grade 1 sprain, on the border of a grade 2, whatever that meant. By that time, Katya the Tiger's future was not only assured,
but the zoo had announced that they'd stored semen from her former mate, Artur, and she would be impregnated the next time she came in season, and she would be expected to produce 3 or 4 cubs. Robert McCall, the wealthy chairman of the zoo's board of directors, announced that he had agreed to fund an animal psychologist to be flown in from San Diego to treat Katya for any psychological trauma she may have incurred during her imprisonment. On the 10th day, Brad Blankenship rolled his red Ford pickup into the parking lot of Waters Waterhole, his favorite bar, and sat for a moment, waiting for the gravel dust to settle. Another hot day. The next day was supposed to be even worse, with a flood of humid air coming up from the Gulf of Mexico. He picked up the seed corn hat from the passenger seat, put it on, and got out of the truck as a 6-door white Mercedes-Benz stretch limo pulled up a few feet away. A wedding limo, Blankenship thought, exactly the kind rented by 8 or 10 horny young bridesmaids before they went out to a bar and got wasted and laid. He'd never seen one at the waterhole, which was basically a rural dive, but nevertheless, it might be an opportunity. There was hardly anyone else around in the mid-afternoon, so he'd have the ladies to himself. He lingered near the front of the Benz, checking out the fat driver. Then the 3 doors on the far side of the limo popped open, and several heavy-set men climbed out into the parking lot. He'd never seen them before, but they were looking at him. He noticed that one of them was carrying a baseball bat. Maybe they were a bar team. "What are you guys supposed to be?" he asked, curling a lip. "The New York fucking Yankees?"
"Well, no."
Virgil's ankle still hurt, but he could swing a baseball bat. He had 3 fielders spread out across the barnyard, young Sam, Father Bill, and Honus the dog. He smacked a grounder out toward Sam, who flinched as it popped up in his face, but he smothered the ball, picked it up, and threw it back. Virgil hit a sharper drive at Honus, who went to his right, snagged the ball on the second bounce, and ran it back to Virgil. He was about to send one out to Bill when his phone chirped. A text message from an unknown phone. The message said, "We're all square." It wasn't signed. He contemplated the phone for a moment, then put it back in his pocket. He was still out there hitting balls when his phone went off again. The sheriff asked, "You got some witnesses where you're at?" "I'm hitting baseballs at a young boy, a Catholic priest, and a dog named Honus up at Frankie's farm. I got witnesses all over the place." "Well, good. Because about 15 minutes ago, somebody caught Brad Blankenship out at the waterhole and broke his arms and legs. All his arms and legs. And his fingers."
"Wasn't me," Virgil said.
"Didn't think it was," the sheriff said. "You take it easy there, Virgil."
"I'll do that."
Frankie came out on the porch chewing on an apple. She was wearing a white t-shirt and ripped blue jeans and sandals, blonde braid falling down her back. She was an American dream. "It's awful hot," she said. "You guys come on inside. I've made some lemonade." Sam and Bill started toward the porch, but Honus hung back, deep in the imaginary field. When Sam and Bill were inside, Frankie called, "You coming? Maybe you and me and Sparkle and Bill could go on down to the swimming hole after the lemonade." Virgil took off his baseball cap and wiped away the sweat on his forehead. Really was hot. He said, "That sounds terrific. Minnesota in the summertime, huh? But let me hit a couple more grounders out to Honus." This is Eric Conger. We hope you've enjoyed this unabridged production of Escape Clause by John Sanford. This program was directed by John McElroy. Executive producer, Sarah Jaffe. Text, copyright 2016 by John Sanford. Production copyright 2016, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.